Hello everyone, Tomasz here on today's episode of the Fujilove podcast, which is brought to you by Fujilove magazine. I am talking to an official Fujifilm ex-photographer from Denmark, Palle Schulz. It's definitely one of the most interesting conversations I have had so far while recording the episodes of this show, and I hope very much you will enjoy it as well.
This is Fujilove, a podcast for Fujifilm X users from around the globe. Thank you for tuning in.
So, Palle, welcome to Fujilove podcast. It's very nice to have you on the show. We never talked before. You just wrote an article for the Fujilove magazine. So it's very, very nice moment now to have you here on the show and talk to you in person. So welcome.
Thank you very much.
Just in the very beginning, I know you're a Fujifilm official ex-photographer from Denmark, right? Is it correct?
That's correct, yes.
And maybe just, in a couple of words, you could share with our audience. So who are you as a photographer? What are you doing? What is it all about in your case?
Yeah, Denmark is a little country, so specializing in a certain field of photography is a bit shooting yourself in the foot to get work. So what I mainly do for a living is product photography. I also do fashion and portraits, but I do a lot of other stuff as well. I try to make more of the work that I like and try to make a living by turning my direction into the areas that I really like, but I still have to do stuff that makes my living, and product photography is a big part of that.
Interesting. This was actually one of the questions I was planning to ask you later during this conversation, because I looked at your portfolio, excellent images, really congrats. I really love your work, but I noticed you are shooting, like a bit like in my case, you are just shooting such a variety of subjects.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, are you actually a 100% photographer? Job wise.
Yes, I'm more or less, but I do so many different things because I'm getting old, and I've learned so many things through my life that people ask me to do stuff that is not necessarily photography. I have to sort of force myself to only do photography, but I'm also a musician. I've been so for many years, and I've started doing videos again. So now I'm picking up on the musician part of life, and I also mix records and stuff. But photography is my main income and my main.
I was just reading your biography just before recording, just to make sure that I am prepared. I didn't know it before. You play guitar, right?
Yeah, I've been playing guitar for many years.
For me, I am a pianist myself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I am. So, when I meet on my way another photographers, musicians, I just feel this connection immediately. So this is exactly, maybe let's start with this one, because it's the same for me. And in my case, I find it such a blessing that I have the music, that I'm a musician, and then, living in this totally abstract kind of sound, world.
Yeah.
And then I love the influence it's having on my photography. Are you also experiencing this crossover of,
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a mindset. It's sort of a way your mind works. Recently, I started, rehearsing a musical instrument makes some new connections in your brain. And I tried to learn something that I never did before. I learned a Meshuggah song.
Okay.
It's actually on Facebook somewhere, where I play this this Meshuggah song, which is extremely complicated rhythmically.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me like 3 weeks to learn it. But that sort of connected a lot of stuff in my mind to have this extremely difficult exercise that I could take into anything else in my life. And I think that music is a sort of a generator of new ways to sort of evolve in the way your mind works, because it's such a complicated thing and still so creative.
Mm-hmm. I'm experiencing similar, you know, similar stories. Do you actually, like, when you go out and photograph, you know, by yourself, are you listening to music sometimes? I mean, now, like, physically, with headphones or whatever, because I know.
No, actually not really. I don't listen much to music, only when I drive in my car. And I really don't know why, but sometimes I think I just need this peace because there's so much music in my mind.
I know what you mean. But okay, but do you, you know, hear or like think in terms of music when you're out there photographing? Does it, you know, it happens to me that I am somewhere, I don't know, in the woods, you know, or in a field exactly by myself, and looking at the landscape or any given, you know, scenario, and somehow certain tunes just, you know, whatever, just pop, and then I'm getting into this other mood and other mode. Does it happen to you that it's kind of?
No, actually not. I'm a very very visual person, so it's the other way around. The visual triggers music in my head, and not the other way around. So it's, I've been photographing longer than I've been playing music. I started playing seriously when I was 13 years old, but I started photographing when I was 7, and I've been really a big fan of movies and cinema as long as I can remember. So I've been always been very visual, and the music sort of followed. So it's sort of a mix, but it's not like mixed together. It's more like one thing triggers the other, and it's more the visual stuff that triggers my my musical thing. So
and opposite, when you're making music, does it happen that you think in terms of colors or, you know, images?
Very much so. It's very much I'm a huge fan of soundtracks. Any soundtrack I can get my hands on, I listen to it outside of the film itself, because it really can set a mood in a super strong way, and I'm a huge fan of that. So I really think very much in terms of the visuals and music as a soundtrack for it. So I really enjoy making music for my videos, because I can set up an emotion that really wasn't in the video to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. This is fascinating. This is, you know, I love this talk already, because I was experimenting with this kind of thing myself last year. I'm a classical musician, right? So I'm, you know, I'm mainly into chamber music, and I organized a couple of concerts where I myself or friends, you know, other musicians, I was putting them on stage. They were playing live, chamber music, you know, behind them on the big screen, I was displaying different photographs, and then I experimented, you know, myself with, you know, the same photographs but different kinds of music. It's worlds apart, you know, what kind of moods you create and how do you actually perceive the image, right? Based on the music. So this is crazy that you are into this similar kind of things, actually.
Yeah, I think that Hans Zimmer is one of the really exceptional guys at that. He made the music for Interstellar, among others. And in that film, he chose to have almost the whole score played by a church organ.
Okay.
And you don't really hear it the first time you see the movie, but when you go into and check the story about it, there's one guy playing a church organ, and it's so far away from science fiction that it can get. But this contradiction is just amazing, and the whole setup is just, it really sets a mood that is super strong. So I really, a lot of times when I compose some music and record it, I have a movie in my head that I try to make a soundtrack for. Then the picture starts to emerge, so it's sort of a two-way trigger, you know. So I you could say that I always think in terms of a music video, more or less, because I sort of think it could be cool to set this scene up with this sort of music to me. You know?
Yeah,
but that also applies to stills, I think. It's just a single frame from a movie in my head.
Right. Yeah. With the stills, it's even a different kind of story, right? It's a still image, but the music is, you know, flowing in time.
Yeah.
So yeah, fascinating. I could talk with you with this forever. Maybe once we will do. I want to refer a little bit to the article you wrote in, you know, for the Fujilove magazine. I love the article. I love the fact that you know, so honestly, you know, wrote about what's happening inside you, about your story, about your experiences. And, you know, what struck me very much when reading this article, I think it was the one of the first paragraphs where you wrote that you are not the most confident person.
Yeah.
And, well, in some ways, it's interesting. I can say the very similar thing about myself. You know, I'm doing all this stuff, but, you know, inside, I'm not the most, you know, there are people who just go for it, who just don't experience this, you know, kind of hesitation or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And what do you think, like, because you say you have been photographing for many, many years. So what do you think this part of the character, this, you know, certain lack of confidence, you know, or what impact did it have on your development as a photographer, actually? Do you see any connection, you know?
I think, you know, I wrote the most personal thing I wrote in that article was why I lack confidence. And that was the thing with my father that has been really good at telling me as a kid that I didn't, that I were bad at anything I did. Mm-hmm. So when that happens so early in your lifetime, you get, it's like your basic programming as a human being. And I always tried to impress my dad for many, many years because I sort of got, you know, caught up in this thing, because if any other human being who you're not related to tells you that you suck at something, you can just shake it off and just think he's an idiot. But when it's your own father that has this huge influence on you as a child, you try to, you know, you try to live up to their demands. But if their demands are never ending, and no matter what you do, you will always be told that you suck, you start believing it at some point. So my sort, what it did that was good for me in a way was that I really tried to do better all the time. Like, it was a struggle to become better, but the problem was that I didn't struggle to satisfy myself, and that sort of disconnects you from your own goals and what you want to achieve by yourself. And I think you're only of value to any other people if you try to achieve your own goals, because those goals will spread out to a lot of other people that will sort of benefit from you trying to become better at what you want to become better at. But if you just try to please other people, you just become sort of empty. It's sort of, you know, we live in a world where there's an enormous amount of control freaks and sociopaths, and they sort of live off the connection that you give them. And I'm not a psychologist, but I sort of figured out if you don't feed that demon and you don't feed the troll and don't feed the sociopath, they completely lose interest in you. And the moment that I stopped caring about pleasing my dad, he stopped calling me. I actually haven't seen him for years because I just stopped feeding him with trying to, you know, pleasure and please him. And that made a huge difference, because then I had to sit down and think, what do I want to do?
So, but may I ask you, is your father still around?
Yes, he is. Yeah, he's still alive, but I haven't seen him for so many years.
Okay, so you don't know if he's following your work and what you're doing?
I don't know. I have no clue. Maybe he does, maybe he don't. I have no clue.
Okay. Uh-huh. And so this moment where you kind of, you know, released yourself from this demand, your dad's demand, did you need time, you know, then to kind of find out what drives you the most, or like, you know, photographically or just artistically?
I had to reprogram myself, and I had to get to terms with the whole luggage you get from this basic programming. I had to learn how to deal with it. And I also write a bit of it in the article, that I sort of tried to figure out how I could use it as a motivation and as a fuel for my creativity, instead of just getting depressed, because I was terribly depressed for many years. But I came out of it by turning the tables and using it as tools for the last half part of my life. So I can use it as a driver. And I wrote about it in an article pretty precisely how I do it.
Right. Yeah, this was the fascinating part. So you were able actually to exactly to, like you say, turn it and kind of redefine what it could do for you, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is amazing. So, and in terms of... in terms of subjects, you know, because I am struggling also with this on a... Okay, I didn't have these kind of experiences like you had with my dad. My parents are actually... You know, I'm a musician and a photographer, and expectations of my parents were very much... now it's changing, of course, after all the years, but were very much put on me as on the musician, you know?
Yeah.
So I achieved some kind of, you know... level of whatever you can call it, success, or just some kind of, you know, position in life as a musician. But then I really got fascinated with the photography, and I felt for some time that this fascination with photography was in a way disappointing my parents, you know, my father also, because I was concentrating on something else. So I was investing time somewhere else. But I think now after the years, I also, you know, started, like I told you, combining those things, those projects, I mean, music. And so... but also, you know, I know the place you were at a little bit also as well, you know, in this regard.
Yeah.
What I wanted to ask you is, because exactly you photograph many different things, and you told me some of them are just to make the living, you know. Do you struggle, or did you struggle with finding actually this thing photographically, which fascinates you the most, or do you know it already, or... It's better not to know it.
I think I just tried a lot of different things and found some of the areas more compelling than others. And what I find extremely compelling is portrait photography. Mm-hmm. And I have quite a big project right now that I'm running over the next year. Called Proud and Confident, which will portray young people that have skills in a way that is much more classic than how you portray youth more or less today in the media and in advertising. You know, they have to... There's some sort of really funny picture. The classic way of seeing them has sort of gone, and they always have to be really... overly expressive, you know, they're like super animated, and I like to tone that completely down and make very classic portraits, and that is a thing I'm working on right now and will be working on for the next year. And that is, when you ask somebody to have no expression at all, it takes almost nothing to make it super interesting. Just a tiny little thing you make them do with their hand, or a way they should think when they look at you, makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Whereas a huge smile says one thing, it's decoded immediately, and then you lose interest in whatever portrait you're looking at. But if you have these really tiny, tiny details of a person expressing themselves, even only by thought or just minimal expression in their face, you become interested in
it. You start wondering, right? What's on the person on the opposite camera? What's on here, his or her mind, right?
Subtlety is really what I'm going for in this project. Another thing I'm really really excited about right now is a fashion project that I'm doing with a partner, and we're on a book project. It's semi-secret so far, but fashion photography intrigues me a lot, because I use some of the same things. I try to tone down the models and set the lighting as a setting more than just lighting a model. You know, I try to lighten the scene because of my fascination of cinema. And that is another thing that I really want to pursue for the next many years. So portrait and fashion is the two things that I really love more than anything else. But for now, I might grow tired. I don't know. To do something else. But for now, that is my biggest passion.
Okay.
And I really want to follow them. So
now, you mentioned a couple of times now toning down the expression or, you know, the. So it kind of came to my mind. I started thinking about your images. They are also, in terms of saturation, right, and colors, they are also rather toned down, so to speak.
Yeah.
Is it also, does it also have something to do with the thing that you want to, you know, keep this kind of aura of mystery? And
I thought a lot about it. When it's not my product photography that has to stand out, everything else is really subdued and toned down. And I know why it is, because I had this conversation with myself where I tried to figure out why the hell I'm doing it.
Okay.
Because, you know, Jonas, he's a hard contrast guy, and he's amazing at what he does. But then I want to make a picture like that, and then I suddenly change direction and go to the subdued colors again. But I know why, and I figured it out why. That's because I like cinematography, and I've been in love with it forever. A movie and a photography for me is a memory. It's either an existing memory or a fantasy memory. And when you put something in your memory, it's more like it becomes more dreamy. It's not so real that you can almost touch it. It's sort of dreamy. And I want to exaggerate that with pictures so you don't consider them as reality. Mm-hmm. It's more or less a dreamy sort of picture that just flows through your mind.
No, lovely. I love the look of your images, really.
Thank you very much.
Did you work a lot? I mean, did you, you know, come up with the look, with the tones, with the toning of the images yourself?
Probably. I've been studying a lot of analog. I've shot a lot of analog films. And I liked when it sort of went wrong in the 80s when I did a lot of photography with an old Nikomat camera, and it came back overexposed and with super subdued colors. And I sort of just followed that. I like the Kodachrome colors, you know, the sort of cyan, and also like the cinematography way of toning pictures. So I try to follow that, and I downloaded, you know, Lightroom presets just to fool around and see if anything would trigger anything that I liked, and then I sort of jumped back to making my own, but always with mostly with this sort of subdued thing. But then, you know, then suddenly I changed direction and make some super hard contrast black and white for a while.
That's what I know the feeling, you know, like the longer I do something or like follow some kind of style, you know, or look, suddenly I have also this urge to just break it, and, you know, I think it's normal, right? And okay, you know, we are almost 25 minutes in. It's a Fuji Love podcast. Let's have a few sentences about Fuji film cameras. So you are shooting 100% Fuji film cameras with your for your commercial projects and your personal work?
Yeah, I've sold my Canons a while back. When the X-T2 came out with video capabilities, I sold my Canons. So I only have the Fuji. I have an old Minolta analog camera, and that's what I have. But now I shoot mostly all my still photography I do with an X-Pro2. And all my video I do with the X-T2, but sometimes for commercial photo I use the X-T2 with the battery grip, because it's sort of handy.
Which Fuji Film X camera was your first one?
It was X-100 in 2011, right when it came out in Denmark.
And what made you at the time, you know, grab this camera?
I had an assignment for a big festival in Denmark, and I was super tired of being pushed in front of the scene for the in the stage for the first three songs, and then pushed out again in these vests they put them in. And then I just left my Canon at home, completely crazy, because I had to deliver a lot of pictures. But then I took this camera. I only had one battery because you couldn't get more than one. You know, in the beginning it sucked.
But yeah, it did, yeah.
I had a crazy reaction to it because everybody just stood up and wanted to be taken pictures of. And I was invited on stage and backstage and follow people around because they sort of liked my camera. It was really weird. So while I was watching the other guys in front of the stage with the big cannons, and I was standing next to the drummer. So it gave me access to a lot of great pictures. And then, of course, they made it much better. And actually, today the X100 is still a fantastic camera.
So what was the main, you know, characteristics of this camera or this system, which, you know, we just ignited, you know, this fascination with this system, and like this, which just made you a Fujifilm user? What was it, the, you know, image quality or character, or was it more the, you know, handling?
Yeah, handling was the first thing, because it reminded me, it's just like my old 80s analog film cameras. And I could stay in the creative zone all the time. I didn't have to be technical at all. I could just make pictures. And then afterwards, I saw the quality of the JPEGs and was totally blown away, because it just could something that my Canon couldn't. You know, I had, with the Canon, you really have to do a lot of work and you only shoot RAW. But with this Fujifilm, I started shooting JPEGs because they were really beautiful.
Okay, but now I can imagine, because as you said, you developed your own, I don't know if you work with your own presets or like your own look. So I can imagine you are shooting RAW?
I do both. And almost 100% of my product photos is more or less directly out of camera JPEG. It sounds kind of weird, but I sort of learned how to figure out how to get the background completely white just with the flashes alone, and I can tone it in a way that I like. So I have to do very little work to it, and I don't need to use RAW. But I do shoot it as a backup if I get any problems.
Mm-hmm. So for this product shows, then you are going for
JPEGs always,
and you are running it in Velvia mode, or is it like?
No, it's sort of different. It depends on the product, but usually it's pro negative, you know, like
okay,
and just the standard with the soft darks. I sometimes use classic chrome for that as well, okay. But it depends on the color of what I need to make.
Sure. And these days, when it comes to your, you know, personal stuff, do you have a favorite lens or the lens which sits on your camera most of the time?
It depends on the work. I really enjoy, for product photography, there's no discussion. It's a 16-55 and a 40-150. Mm-hmm. And the long telezoom I use to narrow the perspective so it doesn't become too exaggerated when I shoot boxes. It has to be almost like Lego. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But for anything else, portrait, the 90 and the 56 is just amazing for that.
Right, amazing lenses. Huh?
Yeah, for street, when I walk around, I always also like long lenses. I enjoy 50 millimeter. I enjoy... the 35 is sort of a great all-round lens that I've used on traveling, but I have an old Minolta lens that I really enjoy. It's not sharp at all. It's should be sort of horrible, but it has a lot of character. Mm-hmm. It's a Rocco 40 millimeter, and I found out that that's because my sort of attention view fits with 40 millimeter. So when I look at something and I take the camera up in front of my eyes, it fits with the 40 millimeter. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's like just taking a shot at the perfect perspective as you just watch the scene. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, wonderful. Palle, we'll be slowly wrapping up. The last thing, okay, you know, if someone would come up to you, like a, you know, younger photographer who is you know, searching, who is, you know, it's like, you know, exactly like what we talked about is doing a little bit of landscape portrait, you know, black and white and color, and he is kind of lost, you know, but he wants to kind of regain this direction, the way, you know, in his photography.
Yeah.
Would you, what kind of exercise or what kind of move or something you would you recommend to such person, you know, to do first, to try doing first?
I think I would ask him what makes him smile, you know, what makes you feel good inside when you do it. I think, okay, if he has a sort of a depression and can't find any joy in anything, that's, you have to start somewhere else. But most people can say, well, I really enjoy this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And really, then do it and do it a lot, you know.
Follow your heart.
Yes, your intuition is the force, as I write in the article. It is the force. Your intuition is extremely strong, and you should never allow anybody to subdue that intuition. And it doesn't mean that you have to take away rationality, because your intuition is combined with the rationality. But you have, your unconscious self is what is you. That is you as a person. And if you try to get away from yourself, you really, you end up in a depression, and it's not cool. You really have to be yourself. And you do that by following your intuition. You can always feel in your heart if you like to be where you are. And if you don't like where you are, you have to be where you like to be. It's super important. And I know a lot of young photographers and a lot of young people, and I also give them advice at some point. And the advice is usually, do it, man. Just do it. Follow your instincts and do it. I don't have to tell you anything, because you'll be a much better version of yourself than I can make you, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it sounds very, very simple, right?
But yeah, but it's difficult to do in real life.
Exactly. Somehow somehow we, all of us, we get lost at some point on the way, right? But actually,
that's also because adult people move along in life with the handbrake pulled. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't allow ourselves to just jump into things, because we have a lot of responsibility. So we get afraid that some of our choices and our intuitions that points towards these choices will lead us astray and lead us in a direction where we will destroy what we have. But sometimes we have to destroy what we have to get something that we really love, because we cannot cling on to everything. We have to give up stuff to get something.
Yeah. Wonderful words. Thanks so much, Pale. I think, I hope, yeah, many, many of the listeners will, you know, yeah, benefit from this conversation. Wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wish you all the best with you know, with your projects, all the enjoyment on your way, and thanks so much once more for being here on this show.
Thank you for having me, and I really have a great respect for your work, and I'm really joyful about your Fuji love and everything you do, and I love everything you do. So thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I hope to have you again at some point, you know, on a regular basis as a contributor in any form. I hope we meet one day finally.
I hope so too, and you're very welcome.
Thank you, Pale. Have a great day. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Fuji Love Podcast. Stay up to date with Fuji Love. Follow our Facebook page and join the Fuji Love Facebook Readers Group. Head over to www.fujilove.com for all the necessary information. Take good care, and we will talk to you next time.